Coming up on Life is a Festival.
I say to people all the time, you should never work harder than your clients. Go into your next session, and your goal is just, how can you help them work hard? How can you help them get inspired to be engaged in their own work? And you are a collaborator. You didn't make that person change their relationship to substance abuse. They changed it. You sat there and you maybe shepherded them, you maybe accompanied them, but they actually had to go through those excruciating moments of like feeling really triggered and not picking up the bottle, or practicing meditation when it's like snorting some cocaine would make me feel a lot better, you know? I mean, that's like brutal work, the brutal work of healing. And this is one of the other reasons why it's so important for you to do your own healing work, because doing your own healing work humbles you. And that helps you understand that when you are helping somebody else, that you are not just like some sort of grandiose healer that is doing all the work for them. They are the hero in the journey.
My name is Eamon Armstrong, and this is Life is a Festival. This podcast is a celebration of thinkers and leaders who live their lives with the open-hearted, experimental joy of a festival. Each week, we converse in complete openness, in an ongoing quest to find those boundaries in our being and melt them into lofty horizons. Life is a festival, only to the wise. Hello, my friends. Welcome back to Life is a Festival. I'm your host, Eamon Armstrong. Today on the show, we have Laura May Northrup discussing her new book, Radical Healership. Now, Laura has also been on my other podcast, the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, to discuss healing sexual trauma with psychedelics. And for this particular episode, we're discussing how to create an ethical and sustainable healing practice. Now, Laura is the kind of healer where she is so potent and just has such a vibe of nurturing that when she came over to my place to do this interview, we actually got so deep into my own personal issues and trying to figure out polyamory and all these sorts of things that we actually had to stop the conversation and reset it and actually really focus on this book. And trust me, you'll appreciate that, because this book really deserves far more than the hour we have today. And I'd highly suggest picking it up. On the show, we discuss why people get into the work of healing others, but also the shadow whys that can negatively influence our ability to deliver ethical healing. We discuss money and why managing money is actually an act of love, and that both overcharging and undercharging for services is unethical. Laura shares her perspective on marketing, and she also shares her experience of writing this book. Finally, we discuss humility and the need to do your own healing work. Because, as Laura says, the client must be the hero in the journey. Laura is an author, an educator, a somatic psychotherapist, and she is a podcaster. Her book, Radical Healership, is available now to purchase. We'll have that in the show notes. She's the host and creator of the podcast Inside Eyes, which is an audio series about people using entheogens and psychedelics to heal from sexual trauma. Laura's work focuses on defining sexual violence through a spiritual and politicized lens, mentoring healing practitioners in creating a meaningful path, and supporting the spiritual integrity of our collective humanity. Laura does a lot, and she's a very fun person to be around and a very nurturing healer, and I think you'll really hear that on the episode today. So without further ado, here is Laura May Northrup. Laura, you have been on my other podcast, the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, and we had such a great conversation. I just wanted to talk more with you. And you've released a book called Radical Healership, which is an anti-capitalist guide for building a sustainable and values-driven healing practice. So I'm really interested in this idea of how we can take our peak experiences in a place like a festival, where these experiments in intentional community, drugs, sex, excitement, but more than anything, like community and connectedness, how can we bring it into our lives? Your book is especially interesting to me because the trajectory that I've noticed that happens is we have this party, heal, serve trajectory. So we go in because we want to party and we want to feel good. And when we feel good in that state, we recognize that we feel bad
in other states. I'm like, okay, there's something here to explore. And we realize, oh, there's stuff to heal. There's trauma, there's conditioning, there's things that we want to change. And then we go deep in our healing. And in going deep in our healing, we realize that our healing isn't individual. And we can't really just heal ourselves. Maybe we'll get into kind of a cul-de-sac of the never-ending healing journey, but there's something else there, and that is to serve. And so this party, heal, serve trifecta happens in a flow, but also concurrently. You don't stop partying because now you're serving. But there's a way that hitting these three marks, I think, really makes your life more like a festival. And what I love about your book, and just you generally as a person who lives in this way, is this really practical, ethical perspective on the service piece, particularly when we're looking at someone who has experienced healing and then wants to serve as a healer. Because there's so many ways that that can go sideways that people aren't really aware of. And your book, Radical Healership, particularly with its anti-capitalist focus, seems to me to solve for some of the problems that I see coming up again and again, particularly within the communities that surround psychedelics, Burning Man, et cetera. So that's why I wanted to talk to you today, because I feel like many of our listeners have had an awakening experience and would really love to turn that awakening experience into some kind of ethical service that really benefits people, but also sustains them. And I think that it's really difficult for people to thread that needle. And I feel like you have, and this book is a how-to to do it. And that's why I wanted to have you on Life is a Festival today. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. You know, one thing that I'm thinking about as you're talking about this is, so you're coming out of a cultural location where there's partying, then there's healing, then serving. When I think of party, I think of play. I think many people actually don't play until they do some of their healing. So this is definitely sort of a subset of people who go toward the fun and then end up doing the healing work. But one of the things that I think really happens for people, just tying it back to capitalism, is that for people who go to festivals and then come out of it, they don't like life when they come out of it and then they want to do some healing work, is that they come out of it and they recognize the ways, maybe they don't articulate it this way, but how capitalism is incredibly isolating. It's not very community-oriented. It's not very play-oriented. And there's something that happens in a fun, playful festival environment that's not as focused on everything being a commodity. There's so much more about the fun that we make interpersonally than the products that we buy. And when you come out of that space, you drop right back into normal life where we're just encouraged to buy. And we're really discouraged to maintain community as a top goal. So yeah, I love this idea of looking at when people come out of a peak experience, come back into this world and see the pain and suffering, see their own pain and suffering, do some healing work. And then of course, what we're going to talk about today, turn it around and decide to offer it to others.
So your book is primarily focused on healers. Let's talk about what that category includes, because I think that some people might be looking at a healer specifically as like a therapist, which you are. You are a therapist. But there's a lot of different ways that we can heal, and there's a lot of different aspects to healing. So who are some of the people who might take value from your book?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think about somebody who does like habitat restoration as a healing practitioner. They're supporting the earth. People have read my book that are like web designers, where they have gotten a lot out of it. So I don't actually think being a healing practitioner, like you don't need to be, quote, a healing practitioner in order to get something out of the book. And I also think that being a healing practitioner is actually a pretty broad category. Activists, I think of as people who are trying to heal our world, though they might not call themselves healing practitioners, but ultimately that's what is part of what's happening. And then for the more kind of like typical, I mean, truly any type of work, astrology, Reiki, tarot, therapy, breath work, psychedelic medicine guides. I think that that's the more sort of traditional audience of who would be reading the book.
And let's talk a little bit about the kind of healer that you are. And in this way, we can locate our audience a bit with you and your work. So I know that you are a somatic psychotherapist. Is that your primary way of identifying yourself as a professional? Is it somatic psychotherapist? Am I being reductive?
I am just like one of those people who's not that like attached to labels. And I feel like I'm so eclectic and so myself. Actually, something I talk about in the book earlier on is there's this person, Eduardo Duran. He wrote the book Healing the Soul Wound. He's a really, really amazing thinker and practitioner. And I have done a couple of workshops with him. And he talks about how, and this was in the context of me being in grad school, he talks about how, you know, when you go to grad school, you learn to sing other people's songs. So you learn to sing Jung's song or Freud's song or, you know, Stan Grof's song, whatever. You learn to sing someone else's song and you learn to sing it and regurgitate it in this really particular way. And when I think about it, like when you write a paper, you know, and you're quoting different people, you're basically singing other people's songs. And he says, being a healing practitioner is how you learn to sing your own song. So do I call myself a somatic therapist? In my head, I just think about myself like I'm singing my own song. But sure, I'm a somatic psychotherapist. I'm also relationally trained and psychoanalytically oriented. And then, of course, I do ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. I really appreciate the value of altered states in a therapeutic frame.
I love the way you answered that question too, because you pulled in such a juicy piece. Because I knew even as I was asking the question, as it was coming out of my mouth, I was like, oh, I feel like this maybe isn't how you identify. The reason that I brought it up that way though, is I've heard you speak about psychedelic assisted therapy as not really the way that one should necessarily look at being a healer, that to be trauma informed, I know that you work in somatics, that there's a lot of other frames and that psychedelics maybe are more of a tool rather than a modality in themselves. Is that an accurate way of thinking about this?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I think about this is that sometimes we get really fixated on the medicine. We're like, MDMA, you know, it's MDMA or it's ayahuasca. And while the medicines are extremely important and I would not want to minimize them, and they are these very, very powerful collaborators in our healing, and I really do think of it as a collaboration between the passenger and the medicine, it's also really important to understand that you live in your body and your body is also doing a whole bunch of healing work in these states. And so I actually think a lot of what goes on in psychedelic journeys is somatic healing. And to not acknowledge that is a disservice to the person who's receiving the healing. I think it makes a practitioner stronger to acknowledge it and weaker to not. Psychedelic healing is psychological, it's spiritual, and it's somatic. It really is all three. There's no way that we make it not all three.
And you were just talking about kind of the inner healer and that the inner healer is working, that the body is healing itself. And I think that that's a really helpful way of thinking about healing broadly. I did trip sitting with Zendo for many years. And as a trip sitter, you're very different than a psychedelic assisted therapist, but certainly the medicine is working in a certain way and you're holding space for that work to happen. And so some of healing, I think, is really about facilitating and encouraging natural processes in the body and in the psyche that may have been limited by certain experiences or certain developmental adaptations that now become maladaptations. So being a healer, I think sometimes you can look at a healer, particularly in the realms that we're talking about, psychedelics, for example, as someone whose job is just to be there for the process, but that's not right either.
Well, this is a huge question. I train people. I also do in California, it's called supervising, but I like basically support therapists to become licensed practitioners. So I spend a lot of time thinking like, what is healing? What are we doing? Because in my role, like teaching people how to do this thing, and I still have so many questions about it. So this is a great question. Like, is being present a very sort of complex, difficult skill? And is that all that we do? And I would say, no, it's not all that I do. It's not all that a therapist does. It's not all that a guide does. But I will also say it's a huge part of it. And being present is a really complicated thing because it doesn't just mean I'm sitting here and I respond when you need water. It also means I am willing to bear witness to what happens here. I am willing to fully accompany you in your journey. And that's not easy work. That's not light work. It can feel really light and easy if you're working with somebody where their material is light and easy. But, you know, if you're working with people who have trauma and to actually bear witness, that's huge. That takes a lot of skill.
Well, and there's also, and this is so much what you're talking about in the book, is there's so much skill around all the other aspects of your life that allow you to show up in that presence. So I like to think about, like, as an artist, a huge part of the work of the artist is simply to create living conditions in which one can make art. So being a freelancer and struggling to like get things in so that you can afford to create space to be an artist, that's actually part of the work of the artist. And I think sometimes we think about as a healer, what their work is to be present in that session. But so much of the work is everything that happens around it, including building a business around it. And a huge part of the work of particularly the type of healing that we're talking about with therapy, with body work, with these healings where your being, I've heard you use this expression, your being is the instrument. When your being is the instrument, you have to be doing constant work on that instrument. And you have to be doing your healing and your cleansing. And so a big part of the work that I know that you facilitate and support in others is to do the work on yourself so that you can show up for others.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is huge. Like anyone who's listening who either wants to be a healing practitioner or is already a healing practitioner, people ask me a lot, like, what's your training should I do? And I'm like, there's a lot of trainings you could do. I could give you a lot of guidance around that, but also some of the most profound work you will do is to heal yourself, because then you know, A, the journey. You've gone from pain to sort of whatever, maybe a healthier state of being or less pain. But also then you have worked through some of the stuff in yourself that you could potentially harm people with. You know, we're really complex beings. Just because you're a healing practitioner doesn't mean that you wouldn't harm somebody. And in the book, I talk a bit about this thing that I call the shadow why. So one of the things that I lead with in the book is what I call just your why, which is, why are you doing this work? And that, knowing that on a very, very deep level, is a part of what guides you to do very good work and build a practice that is thriving and really supporting people. But we all have what I call like your shadow why. And the shadow why is stuff like, how many people became therapists because we want to heal our parents? You know, like there's plenty of people who they go into being therapists, and the people they specialize in are the categories of people who have harmed them the most in life. And so it's really important that we look at and are able to actually bring this to consciousness, like, oh, I'm trying to heal my parents. And one of the reasons, just if we follow that example, that we want to know that is, are you willing to work with someone and sit with them through the moments where they don't want to heal? Because if you're sitting there getting triggered and thinking on a deep level, this is my dad saying he's never going to grow, it can get toxic. It can get kind of weird. And so another reason that your being is the instrument, you need to keep that scalpel clean. You need to clean the instrument and keep it really clear so that you're either not bringing your material to what you're doing, or if you can feel your material, that you can feel it. You know how to keep it in check. And this is, of course, a lifelong process. And I will also add, even if you are someone who practices in a way that is not psychological, it is still really important to do your psychological work, because all we do all the time, relational connection between human beings, is it has some psychological element.
I think that this would be a good time to just give a little nod to your work with Inside Eyes, with your podcast. And we did an interview together about psychedelic healing for sexual trauma, and also sexual trauma that can occur in psychedelic healing. And that's in the Psychedelic Therapy podcast. I'll link it in the show notes if people want to go deeper on that. But for the sake of this conversation, just to talk about how high the stakes are for cleaning your vessel, something that I really learned from you in those conversations and through listening to your podcast is how common it is for people to cause harm because they're not working with their material, not because they're bad people, not because they're predators waiting to harm someone, but actually that they just had unconscious material working in them that came out in a session in a certain way. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to that, because in a sense, that really allows us to look at the stakes in terms of doing your own work and have compassion for so much work we all have.
Yeah, I think this is so important, this piece that you're bringing up about the stakes, because a lot of times people don't realize kind of how far stuff can go, how weird it can get, especially if you are working with a lot of your unconscious stuff. And something that I think is an important number that most people don't know is that in the US, it's estimated that about 7 to 12% of mental health clinicians, so that's a broad range of mental health clinicians practicing in the US, commit a sexual ethics violation with one of their clients at some point in their career. So that may be that somebody has committed one, or that someone has committed many, but that's 7 to 12% of clinicians. And it's a huge number. And of course, when you're going through grad school, you don't think to yourself, you know what, someday I'm going to do something a little out there and come on to one of my clients, or I'm going to have sex with one of my clients, or I'm going to violently abuse one of them. But people actually do that. And this is really coming to light in psychedelic spaces where the power differential there is very, very great because people are inebriated and in a completely altered state. So the stakes are actually really high. But even if you don't go so far as to do something that is a form of sexual abuse, there's all kinds of ways that we misuse each other and hurt each other that are super important for us to pay attention to as healing practitioners. And I also want to speak to this piece that you pointed out about how it's not all people who are sort of these terrible predators that do this. I actually think that that frame of mind is not supportive in stopping harm, because it's really important for us to understand that all of us can cause harm. And actually, most of us do cause harm. And a lot of times people will talk about sort of survivors and perpetrators. But something that we have to remember every time we talk about survivors is that a lot of people, I would say, in fact, probably all people who cause harm are survivors. Those aren't actually two distinct categories, because as we know, hurt people hurt people. And so this is a really important kind of process of becoming really humble and just looking at your own stuff and digging into your own humanity and understanding I'm capable of causing harm just like anyone else. And if I'm going to walk this path as a healing practitioner, I really need to understand that. I really need to not underestimate my capacity to hurt other people.
You know, I think that a lot of people are like, oh, I had the mushroom journey. It was such a big deal. I want to help others in this way. But I think there's also part of it that is into healing, into learning more about healing, and that wounded healer archetype, which is trying to give the gifts that came from their own wounds, trying to turn their pain into the gold that they give others. But also, I think there's also a bit of a preoccupation with just, like, there's just like a nerdy interest in healing modalities. I mean, I'm not a healer per se, but I'm pretty nerdy about healing modalities. Give me some strange exotic procedure where someone injects something into my neck and maybe I'll not be so anxious. Like, sure, sign me up. I mean, can we acknowledge that being a healer and healing, even in spite of its great gravitas and seriousness, it's also kind of fun?
I think it is really fun. I think there's parts of it that are super, super fun. You know, I also do think, though, that a lot of people who really get deep into this work and do a lot of it are just very, very traumatized, and it's not really a choice. Mm. I mean, like, in ways, it is not a choice for me. I am not going to get super into my past, but I just would not be an okay person if I had never decided to embark on healing. You know, there's plenty of people who don't do any healing work, and they manage to make a life that's sort of reasonably fine. Maybe there's some problems and things that they, yeah, don't necessarily ever resolve. That would not have been my life. So it felt like I had to do it. I think another thing is that this is kind of a random piece about becoming a therapist, but I really don't like being in situations where I can't advocate for myself or address harm that's happening. So for example, I talk in the book about working at this cafe where I was being sexually harassed and all this kind of banana stuff was going on. This is when I was in my 20s. And one thing I really liked about becoming a therapist is everything that happens in the room is something that can get talked about. So if, for example, I'm working clinically with someone and they sexually harass me, that's not a situation where, like with my boss, I can't say to my boss, I mean, you could try, but I probably would have been fired. I can't say like, hey, what you're doing to me right now isn't okay. But actually in the therapy room, that is my job to say that. And I do have this just like unending orientation toward truth that I don't know where it comes from or what's going on with it, but that's something that actually drives me a lot in my own healing. And it's something that is a thing I actually really appreciate about being a therapist, because I just really don't want to work in an environment where I'm being harassed or harmed or where someone else is. Like, same goes. If one of my clients says to me, look, I feel like what you said was judgmental, I take that really seriously. And I'm like, well, was it? Yeah, I'm sorry. That was judgmental. Let's work with that. So it's like there's an arena of just like really orienting toward truth and honesty. And I'm just very, very soothed by that.
This kind of tees up something that I wanted to talk to you about. This book seems very geared towards how to create an ethical business as a healer. So let's look at the flip of that. What is an unethical healing business? What are we trying not to replicate in these healing relationships that we're building. And with an eye to what we were saying earlier is that what are unknown unknowns. There are people who get into this for all the right reasons, and they may just not be aware that some of the choices that they're making are not ethical. What are some examples of unethical healing businesses that this book will help readers avoid?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to like smack talk anybody, but you know, I think probably one of the biggest ones is practicing out of your scope of competence, like not having enough training. I think there's a lot of people, then this just sort of runs the like span of all different kinds of healing practitioners. This is huge right now to say I'm trauma informed. And at this point, it means basically like nothing. It means that you look at memes on Instagram that tell you about trauma. I wouldn't say someone's trauma-informed unless they actually have some pretty serious training under their belt or sort of a nuanced understanding of trauma. And I think you shouldn't say that you're trauma-informed if you don't actually have a nuanced understanding of trauma, because people who are traumatized are going to come to you. And if you're not trauma-informed, you're probably going to get stuck in weird psychological loops with them that end up playing out their trauma, because that's what happens. When trauma enters the room, things start to shape in a certain way. So that would be like probably one of the biggest things I would say is like not enough training or practicing in a way that you probably shouldn't be. Another big one that I see, and I have this lens because I'm a therapist, and one of the things that therapists are required to do is we are actually required to get consultation and required to have continued training. Whether people actually get it or whether they get really good training, that's like a whole other story. But there are many modalities that people work in where they don't actually ever get consultation. So for example, I think a lot of psychedelic guides run into this issue where you're working in the underground. Maybe you are somebody who is more self-taught. Maybe you don't have a ton of community. It can be very secretive. Most people don't go out and say, hey, I do this extremely illegal thing. Come network with me. But so what ends up happening is there's not actually a strong culture around consultation. And so people start doing the work and they don't have like a regular group that they go to or people that they go to where they check in and sort of say, here's what's going on and here's where I'm struggling. This is like, I would say, not ethical. We always need to be having other people that we talk about our work with so that it's not just your psyche that is the only eyes on what you do.
It's not just your psyche that's the only eyes on what you do. I really like that as just... put it on a t-shirt. So some ways that we can have an unethical way of approaching healing around not having the proper training, to not having the proper support. I think one of the things that comes up around ethics, when you talk about ethics in the context of psychedelics especially, but healing, is we talk about money and capitalism. So is it ethical to charge $1,300 for a journey? Is it ethical to be a healer who's hosting a circle where it's not affordable enough for people to come in? So there's not really like equal access. Like, is that ethical? But then on the flip side, we have a situation where I think many healing practitioners, particularly those who are coming out of some kind of spiritual awakening, are so eager to give and to heal and to serve that they don't know how to price themselves. They underprice themselves. And in that, they can actually cause harm to themselves and to others by not really being able to offer an appropriate energy exchange. So I think that what happens a lot for healers when they're thinking about how to be ethical is that they're either not aware of how capitalism plays out and they're honestly just kind of healing the most affluent people, which just actually widens inequality, because if the most affluent people have access to the best medicines, then they can compete more in a capitalist context. And so it actually widens inequality. Or they're hyper aware of that and they're undervaluing themselves and they're running themselves threadbare to try to offer this. And they're actually ultimately not offering really comprehensive service to their clients, and they're not expecting their clients to meet them in a proper energy exchange.
Yeah.
So I know this is a huge focus of your book, especially building a sustainable business in an anti-capitalist mindset in a capitalist context. So this is a huge focus of your book. So let's get into money.
Yeah. I mean, basically, yeah, you're hitting the points. We got the overchargers and we got the underchargers. And there's a lot of sort of inner working psychologically around why people do that, which we could dive into if it feels interesting. But one big sort of way that I frame this conversation is that we cannot expect ourselves to sort of solve capitalism through our pricing structures. So capitalism is unethical. And you have to make money to survive in this world. So saying to yourself, I'm going to make the world more equitable by not making enough money for myself and giving all my services away for free or very, very low fee, you're not actually solving capitalism. Yes, you are giving services away, which these people probably really, really need, but you're giving them away at the expense of your own sense of well-being. So I do not think that that is the solution that people should be going for. And also, I think it's really unethical and not useful at all to the person or to anyone to overcharge or to create an environment where you're just basically amassing wealth. People always ask me sort of like, well, what's the right sort of balance or what's the best thing to do? And I think that actually really depends a lot on who you are, what kind of money you actually need to survive. Like, does it make sense to charge $1,300 for a journey? I don't know. Where do you live? What is your class privilege? What are going to be the things that you're going to actually be beholden to financially, like your children or maybe taking care of older people or more, maybe you need to have money to take care of your community? I don't know what your financial situation is. So I don't know if $1,300 for a journey makes sense. But I definitely think that people who have a lot of money and resources need to very much question why they're trying to make more. And people who often the people who undercharge are people who do not have a lot of resources and actually relate a lot to the people who they're serving and giving less expensive services to. But to those people, I say, is running yourself into the ground a solution? We really, really, really need to do the deep work around what am I trying to soothe with money? Because so much of it is death anxiety and not wanting to be uncomfortable. And that is spiritual work. That's not monetary work. I mean, it's spiritual work that underlies making a strong business. So from there, really asking, like, what am I doing with money? What do I actually need? And then the final piece I'll say on this is, like, it's so hard, but building an actual real sliding scale, if you have the financial means to do it, I think is a very reasonable way to navigate this. And that might mean that you have to grow the capacity to talk about money. So that might mean that when someone comes to you and they say, I want to get sliding scale, that you actually say back to them, cool, tell me about your finances. Tell me what's going on. Or that maybe someone comes to you and they say, how much does this cost? And you say, okay, let's talk. Because if you don't have a lot of money, we can do something less expensive. And if you do have a lot of money, I'm going to ask that you pay more so that I can keep offering these services, that I can redistribute wealth through my practice. I mean, these are all potential solutions that people can make, but really there's something about doing your own spiritual work to engage with money from a place that is, I think, more spiritually grounded, doing your own work to understand what you actually need individually and not sacrificing that. And then from there, being able to have really difficult conversations with people about money.
Yeah, I think that one of the tenets of capitalism is that you're not supposed to talk about the money. I mean, that's part of how the structure is reinforced, is to say that, well, it's impolite. And I think that that's something that we should normalize, talking about money and talking about what people need to survive and what people are getting. And when you're talking about this difficult conversation in the context of a sliding scale, that was actually more comprehensive than I was even thinking when you were bringing it up, to say, what do you need? And maybe, what can you pay? And maybe you can pay more. And to actually be totally open about that. I know what it feels like to feel that tension. And if you are a healing practitioner and your way of existing in the world is to heal others and to heal yourself, I think this is a really brilliant way of looking at it that you've pointed out, that, like, go to that and heal that. Bring your healing to your money. And it reminds me of something that you wrote in your book about how you're in the category of undercharging. So what I felt was really compelling in the way that you were writing about how you evolved from this chronic undercharging was that restructuring your practice so that you could earn a higher income was actually an act of love. And this is a kind of a way in which you start talking about how love is an antidote to a lot of the issues that we're having in money in relation to healing, capitalism generally, but that for you, it was an act of love for you to restructure so that you could have a sustainable practice. And I want to bring that up because I think that I'd love to talk about how that can be tangible for someone, because when someone is thinking about that, that makes sense. Yeah, love is all you need. Love is the answer. Let's bring love into this and love will heal. But to me, it seems like this is a more concrete use of love as a way of changing perspective around money.
Yeah, I mean, so I was undercharging to a degree, and just the way that I was running my practice, I was not going to be able to sustain myself. I was working with extremely difficult cases. And yeah, like really, I mean, I was paying my bills, but you know, I wasn't really paying my student loans. I mean, I was suffering. And when I say it's an act of love, I think that it's an act of love to myself. Like I had to actually say, Laura, your well-being is important enough in the world. It's okay to say no to some people and say yes to other people so that you can be financially solid. Because I say in the book earlier on, I really held the idea it was wrong to say no to anyone. So, I mean, people would come to me and I would be like, my practice is full and I also don't make enough money. And they'd say, can I see you? And can I see you for a very low fee? And I would have a really hard time saying no to that. So one part is loving myself enough that I could understand I have limits. I have limits. And those limits, when you're young, can feel like, oh, you know, I'm just worn out from this. But as you age, that chips away at your life. And it also starts to chip away at other things, like the quality of your relationships with other people. I also think it's an act of love in the sense that if you don't run a sustainable practice, all the people that rely on you, they are relying on you being well enough to take care of them. And I know many therapists who have done things like burnt out to the point that they closed their practice or that they took a hiatus that was really challenging for their clients. Maybe they took an entire year off. And I'm not saying it's bad to take a whole year off. It's great. I hope everybody has the privilege to do that. But burning yourself out to the point where you can't work anymore, if you're willing to do the work to not burn out, that's an act of love to the people you've committed to working with. So I think it really goes both ways. You know, I also think it's like, what happens in a healing relationship when the practitioner is stressed out? I don't know, but I mean, I think that's when we start to have our container not very clean. Our instrument isn't very clean. So it's an act of love to the people that you work with, just that you are in integrity with yourself around money so that you're not resenting them, so that you're not bringing your own stress to them, so that you're not having a bunch of unconscious feelings about how much money they're paying you. It's very important that we feel okay about how much we charge. And if we don't, stuff just starts to come out sideways and get really wonky. And I think all of that is an act of love. And a big part of, I think that chapter is called Allowing Love. And I've sort of toyed with a back and forth between amassing wealth and allowing love. And this is another sort of tangible piece. One thing I wish for everyone is that we put as much energy into building beautiful relationships with each other as we do into making money, and maybe even more into community, because ultimately you are going to suffer, you are going to die, you're never going to not suffer and not die because of money. I will say, and I say this in the book, having enough money that you can have healthcare, yes, like super, super important. But there is a point at which more money is not actually going to take care of these pains. But what you get with community is one of the most profound things. It's one of the most profound sort of remedies, or at least sort of balms to suffering and death, which is like other people who just care about you and accompany you, and other people who let you care about them and accompany them. And that is way, way, way more supportive, healing, profound, and fulfilling than being alone, making a ton of money, and you can't maintain relationships because you work 80 hours a week.
So community is so important for all of us. I think community is particularly important for healing professionals. You were talking about earlier about consultation with others is extremely important. Having your own healers in your life to help you clean your instrument. How would you advise younger healers who are starting out, who are wanting to build a practice? They're trying to manage all of these things. They're trying to figure out how to run a business. They're also in need of mentorship. They're in need of community. What's some advice that you have for people who are starting out to start to build those relationships, to find mentorship, to find the kind of support that they're going to need to be successful and sustainable healers?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big ones is just like reach out to other people. The world that we live in now, you probably have joined a listserv that's like Tarot Readers of Maine or whatever the listserv that you're on. You can actually just say, hey, I want to build connections with people. Is there anybody who wants to get together with me? Conferences are a great place to do that. I think taking classes, taking trainings, staying in contact with the people that you went to grad school with or did your training with. I actually was just recently supervising for students who were still in their grad school program, and they had done their grad school program entirely through the pandemic. And I was really sad to learn the level of disconnection for all of them. And I was really encouraging, like, build an email list, like, hang out with each other, find a way, because these people who you went to school with, these are going to be your colleagues for your life. And, you know, just the other big thing is that it's about making some kind of, like, ritual routine connection. So just meeting somebody at a conference is one thing. Just meeting someone for coffee is one thing. But actually saying, hey, why don't we get together weekly or every once a month or once annually to actually sit down and really talk about our work together and build a relationship. And that type of intimacy is also super important in order to avoid causing harm, because you need to have a really safe relationship to go to somebody and say, hey, I think I might be out of integrity with somebody I'm working with, and I really need support. And in that, it's like, I need you to be able to hear me. I need you to be able to help. Don't just say, oh, no, you'd never do that. But also don't say, oh my God, you know, you're a terrible person, I'm running away. But actually say, okay, what's going on here? Because we need to find a way through this, and we need to do something with a lot of care and integrity. And that takes trust and a deep relationship.
Another thing you write about in the book that I think is worth touching on is marketing. And I think marketing is particularly interesting in the context of, if we're talking about gray market psychedelic therapy, that's an interesting space for marketing. But in general, we're in a place right now where all people are encouraged to market themselves in all ways at all times. Even if you don't have a business, you're trying to demonstrate your special, magical, unique life on Instagram all the time. So there's so many grooves that we are culturally slotted into around how to get attention in an attention deficit world. For a healing practitioner who is trying to be in integrity, who really wants to show up, and they don't really want to run a business. They don't really want to market anything. They want to do the work that they're there to do. Without giving away too much from the book, because we're encouraging our listeners to get a copy of this book so that you can have a sustained experience as well with your offering. But can we touch a little bit on your philosophical posture towards marketing the healing arts?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll say there's so much in the book. It's still worth reading, even though I'm going to break this down. So I think about marketing as a form of communication. And I think about branding as basically communicating something that is sort of an essence or essential. And the reason that I like to reframe these is because the term marketing has so much baggage with it. One of the notions that comes with marketing is sort of selling something someone doesn't need or convincing someone to buy something. And when you're a healing practitioner, that's not what we're trying to do. But, you know, a lot of practitioners are like, oh, marketing's gross. I'm not even going to have a website. And I'm like, no one's going to know what you do. Like, you do actually need to communicate with the people who you work with or who you will eventually work with. And so that's why I think of marketing just as a form of communication. You're just saying, hey, here's what I do. Here's who I do it with. And if you need this, not because I'm telling you you need it, not because I'm manufacturing a problem to solve, but because you actually need this, here it is. This is how to contact me. And then with sort of the idea of branding, you know, I kind of go back to that sort of core sense of why you do the work. And if you do the work, for example, because you deeply believe in liberation, let's just say, your branding, I'm putting it in air quotes, basically communicating the essence of your why, is to go in and just have a tone in your, quote, marketing materials that says, I believe in liberation. That's why I'm here. Maybe you have a color tone or images or anything on your website or on your social media that says that. And the other thing you said, you know, we're encouraged to do like a bajillion different kinds of marketing. I am very against that idea, like just so deeply. You should only do marketing that's enjoyable to you. And okay, what I'll say is enjoyable. And if you don't like any of it, you don't have to do five different kinds of marketing. If you love building community, build a network via word of mouth. If you actually enjoy taking photographs and writing little blurbs, maybe social media. If you like writing, write a blog. If you love doing interviews and being off the cuff, like start doing interviews on podcasts and things. I mean, there's so many different ways to take something that you are naturally enjoying and turn it into a way, because it's all communication, turn it into a way to tell people about your work. And this is a part of, I think, really making it sustainable, right? Like, if you don't, like, I don't like social media. And anybody who, you can all follow me on Instagram, but anybody who follows me on there will know that. I post ridiculous anti-capitalist memes in my stories, and I almost never post on my grid unless I am just letting people know about like a service or something I'm offering, because I don't actually like social media. And the thing is, I'm not really trying to get clients off of it. To me, social media is just a place to stay connected to people and sort of interact with people who are already interested in my work. It's not a place to find people to get interested in it. And I think it's important for people to know, like, why are you choosing what you're choosing? Some people choose social media as their marketing tool, regardless of whether they like it, because the shadow why in it is, I want to be popular. I mean, people will say to me, like, what are you going to do to get more followers? And I'm like, nothing, actually nothing, because I already have a full practice. I'm not actually going to do more. I put my book out. I plan to do more podcast episodes. I think I will write another book. But none of that's related to amassing followers. But that shadow why is strong. That's sort of like, oh, but if you have more, it means that you're a lovable person.
This why and shadow why is such an important part of this book. And even like writing a book, there's your why and shadow why. I read a great article once that was like, why you shouldn't write a book. And it had the different whys. And then it broke down like mathematically, if your reason is X, a book won't do it.
Oh, I want to know, what were the reasons you shouldn't write a book? Because I actually thought about things like, I shouldn't write a book because all the paper that's going to go into the book.
Wow. Okay. It didn't touch on that. It was basically like, because you want to write a bestseller, right? And then it goes through and it talks about how many books are published versus how many bestsellers there are, and like how people can game the system to get on a bestseller list. It basically broke down the bestseller thing. And it's like, because you want to make a lot of money. And then it broke down like how much money people make from different books and that sort of thing. One of them was like the romance of the lifestyle of an author. And then it like broke down why that's actually like really.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, anyone who's writing a book can, yeah, attest to that. Yeah, you're like sitting there in so much emotional pain.
I tried to write a book and it's just too lonely. I was like, that's why I do a podcast. It's much, because I get to meet people like you and have like a nice time.
Yeah, no, for sure.
My mental health is not a writer's mental health.
I wrote mine during the pandemic, and that part was more useful because I never had FOMO because everything was on lockdown in the Bay Area. And I was like, well, I'll just be here with my computer.
And I heard you say on another podcast, so I feel like I can bring it up now, that you wrote parts of this book, or certainly it's informed by your own experiences with psychedelics, so that psychedelics were part of you writing this book.
Yes.
So that's cool.
Yeah, no, most definitely. Anytime I got into a place where I'm like, there's something here, there's something that I'm not getting, there's some kind of like space I have to move through. I mean, certainly, you know, I'd go to my own therapy and I would meditate, but sometimes I would do a high dose medicine journey. And I would sit there with, you can just sort of imagine me with like looking just like a deep crust lord in a pile of blankets with my phone recorder on. And I would sit there and be like talking out the chapters into the recorder and be like, this is what you have to say now. And then I would go back and listen to it later and incorporate it and be just like laughing at how ridiculous I was. But you know, a lot of deep wisdom came through.
That actually sounds like a pretty fun process. For me, writing a book was like, try to write an amazing sentence for 2 hours and be just disappointed with all of it. And I was in that kind of process and I was like, no, this isn't for me.
Yeah. I think, you know, when I talk to people, because people say like, how do you write a book? I'm like, first of all, you just have to put the words down and not care about what they sound like. Because I mean, like, I remember I hit this point where I was like, oh my God, I finished my first draft. It's basically done. I would hype myself up like, you don't have to do anything else, which is like a total joke because there's way more work to do. And so I was like, I think I'm totally done. You know, I spent this weekend like churning in, and I finished it and like finished a huge piece of writing, and I felt almost like I had finished the book. And then I went back and read it and was like, I just spent like days writing crap. This is really bad. And that's part of writing a book, is writing a lot of stuff. And this is the hard part. While you're writing, you're like sitting there writing stuff out and like thinking to yourself, I might spend 8 hours today doing something that's like irrelevant. But it's part of the process. Just like you were saying about being an artist, part of the process is that sort of, what do you do to make art sustainable in your life? Part of the process of writing a book is writing a lot of stuff you're never going to use.
Well, and that is, of course, part of the process of being a healer, is suffering through the experience of not being good at it. And
yes, So, oh my gosh. Well, this is actually just like, I think it's, people don't realize how hard it is. I mean, especially becoming a therapist. Also, I think becoming any kind of practitioner, all of it truly is so hard. But when you're a therapist, wow, just like the brutal shame of sitting across from some of your initial clients where they're looking at you being like, help me. And you're sitting there being like, this isn't the same as when we did role plays in school. Like, I actually, you're a live person that's really, really complex and I have no idea what to do.
Well, I've definitely had some therapists where maybe where I've felt like that. But I like to think of myself as quite a complex case, although I'm sure I'm just regularly neurotic. But yeah, no, it's a long journey. And I think that something that's really important in this process of like awakening to service and bringing in this idea of the kind of shadow why is that it's really glamorous to be a shaman. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm going to be a shaman. I'm going to ferry tortured souls across the turbulent river to the peaceful other side, and it will be me that does it, and they will see me, and I will be resplendent in my healing powers. And then in the trenches, you're like, ah, I don't know what I'm doing. This is super hard. I'm going to spend years trying to figure this out. And so that initial glamorous sort of thing that pulls you in, maybe it's good that there's that glamour that pulls you in and you find your deeper love for it. But it isn't that. It's not glamorous, you know, ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, and there's so much in what you just described where I think people can kind of merge with this sort of archetypal idea of a healer. What you described, it's sort of like, yeah, a shaman or a sorcerer or something like that, some kind of special, like a priest or whatever. I think there can also be this kind of like all-giving mother style archetype that's kind of like, I will love you into being a healthy person. I will love you into healing. And ultimately, what you will find if you are in this work or if you are going to enter into this work is that it's actually the person who is seeking the healing that does a lot of the work. I say to people all the time, you should never work harder than your clients. And if you are working really hard, go into your next session and your goal is just to, how can you help them work hard? How can you help them get inspired to be engaged in their own work? And you are a collaborator, but ultimately this sort of idea of, you know, and then I'm going to feel so powerful. It's like, you didn't make that person change their relationship to substance abuse. They changed it. You sat there and you maybe shepherded them. You maybe accompanied them. You were willing to bear witness to it, but they actually had to go through those excruciating moments of like feeling really triggered and not picking up the bottle or like sitting there and practicing meditation when it's like, okay, actually snorting some cocaine would make me feel a lot better, you know? I mean, that's like brutal work, the brutal work of healing. So, and this is one of the other reasons why it's so important for you to do your own healing work, because doing your own healing work humbles you. And that helps you understand that when you are helping somebody else, that you are not just like some sort of grandiose healer that is doing all the work for them, that you are actually supporting them to do, they are the hero in the journey.
Mm. May we be humbled so that they may be the hero of their own journey. I think that's so important. I think that even, you know, with my family and with my loved ones and with my friends, it was actually psychedelic peer support trip sitting that really helped with this. But I always wanted to be the one who helped them. I wanted to help them and I cared for them and I wanted them to be helped. But part of it was my own sort of egoic kind of like, I want to be the one who saved you, who protected you, who pulled you back from this ledge. I want to be that. And recognizing that that was a sense of unworthiness and lack in myself that was then projecting onto them that they needed me. And I feel like I've become a much better friend now because I know how to say things like, well, how can I best support you? Would you like a reflection? Would you like me just to listen? Like that kind of like checking in. And I think that that's something to take it beyond the scope of people who desire to be in healing practices. There's a lot of what you've shared in this book and a lot of what we've talked about on the podcast today that is universally valuable in the context of how to approach someone who is suffering in a way that is of service to their healing, whether that's a friend, whether that's something that you're dedicating your life to. I find that for me, the more humble I am able to be, and I'm not that humble of a dude, I do my best, but the more humble I'm able to be, the more I can really tangibly see more value that they experience by my presence.
100%. And I just want to highlight, like I'm putting a giant highlighter over everything you just said, because for anyone listening, that right there is the work around dismantling the shadow why. Like so many of us want to be loved, want to be really good at what we're doing, whatever, want to be the one who helps the person. I talk in my book about for people who have experienced a lot of trauma, sometimes the thing that we want is to feel like we're the one who's sane or together and the other person needs us so bad. We're sort of projecting onto them all the stuff we don't want to deal with in ourselves. And that process of actually saying, oh my gosh, I'm doing this because I don't feel worthy or because I feel bad about myself. It's so powerful and we can feel so ashamed to admit it. But then when we do, it's just like, yeah, that's what I'm doing. And it's not helpful. And then what you're saying, that actually showing up to healing relationships or really any relationship where we're not projecting our own stuff onto other people, the service that we offer is of such a much higher caliber and people get so much more out of it.
I can't agree more. And I definitely have found this in my own life. Like the more that I lean into simply being present and having unconditional friendliness with someone who's going through whatever they're going through. And even then, if they're like, oh, thank you so much. And I'm like, well, you're welcome. And also like you did the work that you just did. And it's really beautiful to witness. And I'm grateful that you're grateful that I was here. And also I'm just in awe of the work that you've just done. And again, I'm not a healing professional at all. I help people who are tripping sometimes. But it's not just that dismantling that shadow why, finding that humility, and that it's not just that it makes you more effective, it actually makes your work more easeful. And then to the point of the book, more sustainable, something that you can keep. So when you're not just like trying to like drag someone across the finish line because of your own unpacked baggage around needing to be a healer versus you're like, okay, well, they'll get there. They're in their process. Their pacing is happening in a certain way. I can help them here. Maybe I can't even help them in this moment, but I can ask a colleague for support. It seems like that would all become a lot more easeful.
Absolutely. I think it all becomes more easeful. You know, I think about it too, like being right-sized and just recognizing I actually can't make you be different. I can only accompany you. I can support you. This is the part where we start to merge with like a saint-like or god-like archetypal energy of the idea that I could actually do something like that to you. We're human. We're not gods. We can't. And so, yes, it makes everything so much more easeful when you just hang out in your right-sized place. Like, wow, I'm working with somebody who doesn't want to change or is struggling to change. I cannot do that for them. You know, there's always sort of this complex balance between doing and not doing and pushing versus allowing. And I also say, you know, I think there's also a complex balance between taking pride and being humble. Because I would never want to say through all of this, when somebody says to me, thank you so much for what you've done for me, there's this sort of like, how do I strike the balance of humility of, yeah, and you also did that work and I'm not going to take this and sort of ramp up my ego with it or take it and start using it to heal all my wounds inside, or I should say like cope with all my wounds. But also, how am I going to really take the compliment? I did help you and I did do a good job and I should be proud of that. And this is a twisted sort of process in a world where we are just so, I mean, here in the US where we're doing this interview, so narcissistically wounded. It's so difficult for us to know how to take in a compliment where we honor the other person and also receive what this person is offering without twisting it into something else.
Well, may we all find our right-sized place and may our right-sized places continue to grow and expand as we do. And it is an art and it is a dance. And I think one of the big lessons from this book and from this conversation is also just that to have patience with the process and to have patience with yourself as you're doing it and to find your real whys and let them sustain you and find a good practice that works for you and continue to iterate it, but to also have patience and learn and grow. And yeah, I feel like that's really a key lesson. And yeah, I will give you a compliment. I think you're great. I think this is a really splendid offering. And I think that considering all the myriad things that you do, you're a great example for someone who is interested in a healing path. Because you didn't just write a book when you started, right?
But, no, I did not.
But you've managed to write a very beautiful and very helpful book in the process of your work. The book is called Radical Healership. It is an anti-capitalist guide for building a sustainable and values-driven healing practice. And it is available now and you can have it in the show notes. And I highly recommend it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival.
If you liked the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.